This is an audition record presenting Evangeline Baker in the role of a newscaster. The title is only tentative, and the program attempts to attract the women audience by having Evangeline tell rather than report the news, by having her place considerable emphasis on news and features which should be of interest to women. Evangeline Baker with the Women's Slant on the News. It's time once again for KGO to present Evangeline Baker with the news of the day, a summary of local and national news designed to delight you as it informs you. And now Evangeline Baker and the news.
Good afternoon, this is Evangeline Baker. We've been hoping all day that by now we'd be able to report that the hurricane churning across Florida had blown itself out. But all the late stories out of Florida cities keep telling of more high winds, more destruction, more crop loss, more property damage, and worst of all, death. The latest word is that the 150-mile-an-hour winds continue to sweep across the peninsula into the Gulf of Mexico. And you get a better idea of how powerful those winds are when you consider that here in San Francisco, we seldom experience anything stronger than a 25-mile-an-hour wind. Communications have been badly snarled by the storm, so reports on damage in the stricken area are slow in coming through. Some perhaps are exaggerated, and let's hope so. Others may not be complete. But there seems little doubt that property damage will run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Up to now, we have only two reports of death because of the hurricane. They say this is the most violent storm to strike Florida in a decade. It first loomed up a week ago, and weather forecasters have kept close track of its movements, trying to plot its probable course and give warnings which could save lives. Modern science is playing an important role in minimizing the death toll in this tragic storm. 20 years ago, the same storm probably would have killed hundreds, even thousands of innocent people. You remember that hurricane which struck Miami back in 1926? Remember what happened then? Well, several hundred people were drowned, and it was a needless loss, that is, in terms of what we now know. And here's why. In 1926, the storm struck Miami, and then almost as suddenly as it had hit, the storm seemed to pass away. People poured out of wrecked buildings and storm shelters to survey the damage. It was a natural curiosity. And then, without warning, the storm swept the city again. Scores of persons were literally blown right into the bay. What had happened? It's now known that the hurricane was moving in a crescent-shaped pattern. The unsuspecting Miamians were caught off guard when the back half, or other end of the crescent, struck them. The open part of the crescent had been only a lull, and not the end of the storm. Since then, meteorologists have made tremendous strides in plotting the course of these devastating storms, of acting as a warning system, almost like the air raid warning system in London during the war, sounding the alert when a storm approaches and the all clear when the enemy is past, in this case, the hurricane. I said that the tragedy of 1926 in Miami might have been avoided, that it was needless. Well, if they'd had the modern system of storm detection then, perhaps the victims would not have exposed themselves to the snapping, murderous tail of that storm. You've probably heard of these hurricane-detecting planes. Once a hurricane or storm is sighted, brave pilots set out in planes to observe the storm, to check on its strength, its depth, its course, and to report their findings. Milton Carr of the United Press rode in one of these planes. It was a huge four-motored aircraft. For 2 hours he rode, nervously, sick, and probably wishing he had never taken the assignment. But there he was, strapped into his seat in a storm-rocked plane, bucking its way through a hurricane, almost like a moth in a wind tunnel. The hurricane was bearing down on the coast of the United States from somewhere between Bermuda and Puerto Rico. The winds raged about 140 miles an hour, ugly black clouds. The huge plane poked through the outer fringes of the storm. Immediately it began a wild course, bobbing crazily up and down, the altimeter jumping between 200 and 800 feet. The correspondent says he thinks the bumps came so fast the delicate instrument couldn't even keep up with the movement. Then there would be crazy twisting side motions of the plane as it bounced around in the storm. Now and then it would move ahead. Sometimes it seemed suspended in midair, unable to move forward, only up, down, or sideways. Suddenly the plane dropped. It fell to within 250 feet of the ocean which the correspondent Carr says looked like a giant vanilla milkshake in a mixer. Adding to the terror was the shrieking wind which drowned out even the constant surging beat of the four powerful engines. Then suddenly water began to pour into the plane through the roof and the sides, and up front the pilot and crew worked desperately to right the plane, to guide it through the murderous storm. And then there was a bright glare. The plane had broken through the storm, and once again it was in the sunlight, outside the storm and in relatively calm weather. But a minute and a half later, the plane again entered the storm, entered the other half of the donut-shaped hurricane. After 2 hours, it was all over. The plane landed safely, battered to be sure, but home again, home with valuable information about that terrific storm. Information to help chart the course and nature of the storm, information which, in 1926, could have spared hundreds of lives in Miami. There's storm warnings of another kind along the East Coast, but they're political storm warnings, and not warnings of a powerful, uncontrollable wind. The storm warnings are being hoisted in New York, where the United Nations General Assembly has gone back into session. Our own Secretary Marshall posted the warnings when he submitted what might be called a second Marshall Plan. Unlike the original and now famous Marshall Plan, this one isn't for the economic rehabilitation of Europe. More properly, it could be called a proposal for the political rehabilitation of the United Nations. Unlike the first Marshall Plan, this second proposal applies to the whole world and not just to Europe. Its two essential points are these: placing a curb on the big power veto and the creation of a little assembly commission to maintain a vigilance over world peace. The Russians were caught napping by the proposal and didn't offer a ready answer. But Soviet delegate Vyshinsky says he's going to state Russia's proposition very soon. And now, before we bring you news about a change in the president's cabinet, here's just a word from Tony Moore.
2,500 patients in local military, veteran, and marine hospitals need the kindly hand of Red Cross. More volunteers are urgently needed to bring comfort and entertainment to these men. You are needed. Volunteer one day a week. Call Red Cross, Underhill 1-6000 to register.
An important page in America's history will be dated September 18, 1947. The record will show that on this date, for the first time, the president's cabinet was reduced in size. This reduction was brought about by the induction of James Forrestal to a new office in American government, that of Secretary of Defense. That's a sort of composite of the Army, Navy, and Air Forces. The new office was created in the last session of Congress when the armed forces were reorganized. You'll probably recall it as the much-discussed Unification Bill. Well, under that law, the Army, Navy, and Air Forces were given equal status. That is, the Air Forces were put into a separate department with equal stature with the Army and Navy. And now overall boss was provided for the Army, Navy, and the Air Forces affairs. In other words, one new cabinet post was created, making 11, but two were reduced from full cabinet rank, which makes the cabinet of the president a 9-man board now. Originally, James Forrestal, who had been Secretary of the Navy, was not scheduled to be inducted as Secretary of Defense for another week, but President Truman, who is returning on the battleship Missouri from South America, sent along word to swear Secretary Forrestal into his new office right away. The only reason the president gave for the speed-up was that he was disturbed by the general international situation. A fine old San Francisco political campaigner has decided not to enter the race for mayor this year. Angelo Rossi, who was active in civic affairs for more than a quarter of a century and who spent 13 years as San Francisco's chief executive, says that's enough for any man. He's done as much as he should be required to do, and he wants to stay out of the running. Mr. Rossi told Hugh Elliott of the KGO newsroom a few minutes ago that he's grateful for all the urging he's had to try for the mayor's race, but after thinking it over very seriously, he's decided not to be a candidate. So that reduces the field of announced candidates to 3 men: Judge Elmer Robinson, Supervisor Chester McPhee, and Congressman Frank Hebner. Mayor Lappin, you'll probably remember, said when he ran for office that he would only serve for 1 term. And as though to remind himself of that promise, he's kept a rather interesting calendar on a big oaken library table across the room from his own desk in City Hall. On one end of his calendar are the words, "Days in Office." Beside that are a series of numbers marking the days he's held the job. At the other end of the calendar is another series of numbers. Beside them is the inscription, "Days to Go." Someday there will be only the number 1 in that space to the right, and then there'll be a new mayor of San Francisco. Which reminds us, he's going to be your mayor, you people living in San Francisco. So be sure you register and vote for the man whom you want to hold that high office. That's the responsibility and privilege of citizenship, you know, to vote for your leaders. So be sure you're eligible. Register now to vote in the November 4th election. No news program these days is complete without a report on football and baseball and the Bay Area and the nation. Well, this weekend, three favorite teams displayed their wares before crowded stands, and two of the teams came out winners. On Saturday, there was that 33-7 victory over in Berkeley when the University of California opened its season against Santa Clara. Yesterday, the Galloping Gales of Santa Clara, always crowd favorites in this area, defeated Portland University 26-13. In professional football, the San Francisco 49ers had their perfect season record spoiled when the New York Yankees won 21-16. That game, according to the experts, ran true to form. And in baseball, the San Francisco Seals still lead the Pacific Coast League by one game, even though they broke even in two games Sunday with the Sacramento team. Now, among other things, I have a story about hemlines, which I'll tell you in a moment after this message from Tony Morris.
A tip to brides. If you have been a registered voter, you must re-register under your new name in order to cast your ballot at the important November election. Registration closes next Thursday. Many downtown stores have deputies to make registering convenient. If you have never registered, now is the time. 38 public schools are open evenings for your convenience.
Have you joined the hemline struggle? Well, if you're an independent female who refuses to be stampeded by fashion's mysterious ways, you'll be pleased to know that not every fashion authority considers long skirts a must. On the side of sweet reasonableness is Man Boucher, one of our leading dress designers. He says, each dress has a length, a purpose, a silhouette, and a mind of its own. He's shortened the evening dresses in his own collection and lengthened his day dresses, but has no set formula and says he does not believe in stunt fashion. This is all very practical and reassuring, we say. What it amounts to is just this. First, consider the purpose of the dress. Is it for sports or country wear, for driving or marketing? Then perhaps its present length is quite all right. If its purpose is cocktails and dining or the theater, then maybe its hem should be dropped down a couple of inches. But first, consider how you will use the dress before making a drastic decision and wear the length that feels comfortable to you. This time, it's the girls who are leaving the farm for the glamorous city. A sociology professor at the University of Minnesota, and I think maybe we shouldn't tell his name, says that in some Midwestern counties, men in their early 20s are outnumbering the girls nearly 2-1. The girls, he says, are going into the town so fast that many Midwestern farmers can't find wives. Quite a problem to the farmers and the sociologists. It will be to the girls, too, when they find out about the man shortage in the cities. To keep the girls on the farm, we recommend making farm life easier, more profitable, and more attractive to women. More modern conveniences and social contacts would help. Today's farmers will have to invest in electric refrigerators, to say nothing of helicopters, in order to keep the girls satisfied. However, it's an ill wind, they do say. The stenographers in the city are already writing to said professor asking, where are those would-be farmer husbands? The professor's name? It's Douglas C. Marshall. And now this is Evangeline Baker saying good afternoon and hoping you'll be with us again tomorrow afternoon at 4:15 when we tell you more about the news.